This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, is Jeb Bush running for president, and could he win? Also, Democrats and Republicans spar about the gender wage gap. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Errol Morris's documentary, The Unknown Known, asks whether Donald Rumsfeld can see his own blind spots. Then, a new app and the merits of speed reading. And then, HBO roasts the tech industry in its latest series, Silicon Valley.
Jesus Christ, I memorized the hexadecimal times tables when I was 14 writing machine code. Okay? Ask me what 9 times F is. It's 75. I do not need you telling me what binary is, just like I don't need you thinking about soup or taking pictures of it.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Clinton contemplates a presidential run in 2016, and now a Bush does too. Jeb Bush floated the idea of a presidential campaign this week, and conservatives were apoplectic. Can a pro-immigration reform, pro-Common Core Republican win the GOP nomination? Then, what happened this week when the former CIA director criticized Senator Dianne Feinstein as deeply emotional? Is there still a double standard for women in politics? I'm joined in Washington today by John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hi, Emily.
Hi, David.
The presidential campaign of Jeb Bush, the younger brother of George W. Bush, although he always seemed like the older brother, even though he was the younger brother. We can talk about that. The son of George H.W. Bush, that potential 2016 campaign is the latest topic of speculation in politics. Chris Christie, the potential centrist moderate candidate for the 2016 GOP nomination, is on the rocks because of Bridgegate. And Jeb Bush has emerged as the potential favorite son of the classical Republican establishment. Bush favors the Common Core standards. He favors immigration reform. He says of illegal immigration that it is not a felony. It's an act of love. And he is generally very dismissive of the poisonous politics of the country. John Dickerson, is he a serious candidate if he runs?
There are a lot of hurdles to the Jeb Bush candidacy, and even the things that would be in his favor, which are that he's a former governor. There's a lot of Republicans like governors over senators. He has a good fundraising base, and he has a relationship. He comes from a key swing state, and he has a relationship or a view towards Hispanic voters that Republicans think would be more appealing than the rest of the party. But he hasn't campaigned since 2002 when he won his second term as a Florida governor, one problem. The campaigning has changed so much in that period of time. And then his other big three hurdles are, one, that he comes from, I liked your phrase, the classical part of the Republican Party, the sort of establishment, what used to be called the Country Club Republicans, what used to be called the Northeastern moderate Republicans. There's a debate in the party, and once you align yourself with that group, you immediately gain enemies on the other side. And then his other two problems, just quickly, one is, of course, the family name, not just because of the fact that he would have to defend his brother's foreign policy, but also because the Bushes, both of them, are considered by conservatives not sufficiently fiscally conservative, his father breaking that tax pledge in 1991. And then finally, as you mentioned, not only is it Common Core and immigration, but on taxes, Jeb Bush last time in 2012, when all Republican candidates who were running at the time said they would not trade $1 in tax increases for $10 in spending cuts, Jeb Bush said, I'd take that deal. He has said that signing the anti-tax pledge put forward by Americans for Tax Reform and Grover Norquist is a horrible idea. So he's basically in a fight with the party on the three hottest red button issues of the party.
Emily, given that, why is it that the Bush campaign, the Bush candidacy, is being floated so seriously? And why is it that serious people are saying, oh, he is the straw that stirs the drink? Once it takes his decision about whether he's going to run will shape how the 2016 race shapes up.
Well, partly it's about the current problems of Chris Christie and the fact that there's no obvious other candidate. And partly it's a wave of nostalgia, I think, by the kind of strain of Republicans you guys were both just talking about who don't have another champion out there. And this sort of, I think, pining for a return to sanity and a more mainstream version of the Republican Party that might actually be able to win the presidency. Because if they stick with the side that is against Bush on those three big issues, they're going to lose another election unless they get super lucky and the Democratic candidate blows it or they come up with some really charismatic, great guy who somehow threads the needle, right? No, wrong. You're both looking quizzically at each other, which isn't a good sign.
I don't know. I was waiting for John. No, John, I was going to. Wisdom figure here.
No. I mean, I think here's the interesting thing about a Jeb Bush candidacy that I think everybody should want. So there was a draft Jeb Bush movement. And then subsequent to that, he's spoken about running. And he's basically said that he doesn't want to run a kind of slide in between all of the current positions kind of race. He wants to run a race in which he would challenge big chunks of his party. Those are, A, just at the most base level, incredibly entertaining. B, they are soil tilling. I mean, they churn up a bunch of stuff, and parties survive from this. I mean, Eisenhower and Taft had a massive fight. Reagan and Ford, huge fight. Reagan and Bush, massive fight. Rockefeller and Nixon. I mean, there are, of course, Bush and McCain. There are big fights that nevertheless lead to two-term Republican presidents, and they're good for a party. They air all this stuff. They have ideas get spread and pollination happens, and so that would be great for the Republican Party. But I don't know that Bush, two things. One, has the skill to pull this off since he hasn't run since 2002, and he's very prickly. And I think he would get irritated right away with, like, Twitter by noon. And he has in the past tended to characterize his opposition as kind of heartless. And I think once you get into motivation judging, which is basically what happens pretty fast in politics anyway, it devolves into a, like, cage match. And you may be trying to till soil and trade ideas, and basically it gets into, like, absolute personal vindictiveness instantly.
Right. And can I add to that, which
Please
is
do.
Three and four. Three is that despite being prickly and despite holding these positions which are at odds with the majority of his party, he's actually a kind of boring candidate also. He's not prickly in a Chris Christie way. I mean, Chris Christie has, like, the huge amount of energy and is charismatic. Jeb Bush is not charismatic. That's number three. And number four is, there's anything we've learned about presidential campaigns over the years, is that the people who do well in presidential campaigns really, really want to be in them. And it's clear that Jeb Bush does not really want to be in this race. And that would show up quite quickly, I suspect.
I think you're right, David. There is a sort of eau de huntsman that hangs around Bush, which is that he's kind of – he's not a happy warrior. There's a little bit of sort of sniffing at the elements of his party who have views he doesn't like. And it is a shame because I want this kind of candidacy on the left and the right. I mean, the left is basically totally given up. They've just, like, the committee to have a totally uninteresting nomination seems to have met. Picked Hillary Clinton, and then they're going to all go to the Hamptons for the weekend or for the rest of the 2 years.
Does the talk about Jeb Bush mean that the mainstream Republican establishment, or the classical Republican establishment, has given up on Christie? Is Christie's campaign dead, or can it come back? We're still,
I mean, isn't this
out.
All about the U.S. attorney investigation and whether what they find out? Because now we're in this kind of stalemate moment where the legislative investigation can't go anywhere because a judge very strangely refused to make Bridget Kelly and other people turn over these important documents. But there's no reason the U.S. attorney is going to stand for that. I would assume those documents will come out, and the fact that it's all going to take longer is going to make it harder for Christie to recover quickly.
I mean, he had a huge, as we've discussed before, he had a huge hill to climb before the George Washington Bridge problem. I mean, temperamentally, he's not suited to the kind of places that the caucuses and primaries are going to run. He's got the wrong positions on a number of things. And the pugilistic thing it's some sort of repeating number one again. So he had those hurdles. Now he has this hurdles. But people love a redemption story. They love a comeback story. And by people, I mean those of us in the media. You remember when McCain was supposedly dead? So I think there is a set of sentences ready to be written with Chris Christie's name to just drop in about a comeback story.
Yeah, the past and the future look better than the present. Big surprise.
Yeah, I guess that's
Can I ask
I guess
one
it's as simple as that.
Very quick question in closing to you, Emily, maybe? So every
maybe.
Other element of the Republican Party has shifted quite far to the right in the past 25 years. The Bush family hasn't really. I mean, Jeb Bush and George W. Bush are more conservative than their father was, but they're not crazily more conservative than their father was. Why is that family relatively immune, relatively oceanic in its movements compared to the Republican Party as a whole? Is it just the force of a family keeps you steady?
Well, they have this long-standing role. I mean, I know that George W. is in Texas, but they're really this Yankee Republican family based in the Northeast. They have a century of accomplishment of a particular kind behind them. And George W. Bush was pretty conservative. I'm not sure I really agree with that part of the thesis.
Well, not relative to the – I mean, if you look at his positions
not
on immigration
– Ted Cruz.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at his position on immigration and No Child Left Behind, he's basically got his brother's problem on federal role in education and pathway.
But look, someone has to stand in this space. I mean, if the Bushes – I guess one way to think about it is the Bushes with their – must be hundreds of years of history. I just happen to only know about a century of it. If they can't continue to occupy the Yankee Republican kind of sensible conservative space, then who possibly could?
Coming up, what happened when the CIA director said a female senator was deeply emotional? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. An emotional topic. Women, their feelings. Can they manage to deal with the rough and tumble of politics in the objective, clinical way that's required? So a favorite Democratic campaign issue reared up on two fronts this week. First, Republicans in Congress blocked a bill that would have allowed employees the right to share pay information with colleagues and also had employers report pay information about gender and, I think, racial pay disparities to the government. Meanwhile, former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden got whacked after he said of Senator Dianne Feinstein that she was pushing for the public release of the Senate report on CIA torture. She was pushing it for it because of her deep, deep emotional feeling about the issues. Emily, are women like Dianne Feinstein in fact too emotional for politics?
I mean, you know from trying to deal with me every week that I burst in tears and we usually have to stop taping in the middle so I can recover myself. So the amazing thing about this dismissal.
You are recording right now from a fainting couch, aren't you?
The reason it is so amazing that Hayden said this is that Dianne Feinstein is maybe the least emotional person on the planet. She is the epitome of the second wave feminist who has figured out how to succeed by acting as professional and as unemotional in every setting as she possibly can. And, you know, her career started out 20 years ago with a fight over gun legislation where someone in the, I think the Senate, or actually, no, it was in California, said, oh, the gentle lady just happens to not know anything about guns. And she completely took this on. This is how she got started. So there's just this fabulous irony here. And obviously, Hayden should be ashamed of himself. But my favorite part of the story is that it turned into a big opportunity for umbrage taking for people like Senator Lindsey Graham. Everyone was rushing to Feinstein's defense. And it turns out that right now in American politics, the way to make hay over a sexist comment like this is to point it out and then poke the commenter in the chest as many times as possible.
So can I ask a question about being emotional?
Yes. Okay. Not that I would know anything about that.
No, but we all get emotional about things and our emotion overtakes our reason. And particularly when our prerogatives are being trampled on by someone else, which is in this, you know, the CIA is trampling all over the Senate. I mean, so, there's no way I can extricate myself from this. But I mean, like, why isn't what?
You, the reason you're down a rabbit hole here is you need to come back because you said something. Your emotion overtakes your reason. That presumes
right.
These two things are distinct. Your emotion and your reason
are
allied. They're connected, and the one informs the other. And it's perfectly fine to have emotions
that
inform your reason. Maybe Michael Hayden should feel shame. That might be a useful emotion to feel about
having tortured people. But the point is, to say someone's emotional about something isn't that big of a
It shouldn't be. I actually think, what's so pejorative
That was the question I was
Is it only pejorative because you
over?
Said it to a woman?
Yes. Thank you. God,
because of the way he said it. He said she's feeling emotional about this. And then he said this isn't an objective response she's having. As if her emotions had overcome her reasons. As opposed to she feels really passionate about this. Gee, when we're talking about torture, isn't that a natural way to come at this question?
Right.
He was using it to decide.
Also, the fallacy that he's putting forth that objectivity is in fact a thing, that there is an explicitly clear individual, particular truth that we can define that everyone would only agree on if only they stopped being so emotional, which, of course, is nonsense. Objectivity is just – when people say they're being objective, they're just saying, shut up while I give you my set of facts.
Well, that may or may not be true. But you also – emotion may inform reason, but it also does – there is still – room, if you agree that emotion and reason are mixed, to get to a good result, there still should be room for people who actually fly off the handle. You know, there are times when there is an emotional response that does overcome being able to see something in a clear-eyed way. But back to your point, why is it pejorative?
Right. I mean, Bill Clinton, if you think about Bill Clinton,
right.
the greatest politician of our time.
Right, John Boehner.
But Bill Clinton was a much better politician than John Boehner. And Bill Clinton used that to such great effect throughout his career.
Absolutely. But the reason why this Feinstein comment has gotten a lot of attention and helped prove what Hillary Clinton said last week about how, yes, of course, there's a double standard for the way women are treated in politics and the media is really guilty of that double standard all the time, is that you just wouldn't have this playing out for a man. John Boehner can cry 50 times and no one is ever going to say, oh, his response to this deep burning problem is not objective. It's, quote, emotional. It's just not going to happen.
Well, they would say it. It's just nobody would pick up on it.
No, I don't think they'd say it. Not like this. Not in this dismissive, like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about and he can't be trusted, which is essentially what this was about.
Right. I think every time Boehner has been cried, it's been highly praised, never questioned. I'm not exactly sure how I logically move into the space, but so isn't it
just let your emotion flow.
One problem with not allowing us to talk about the emotion in women politicians, emotion as it's related to women politicians, and sort of saying that's out of bounds whenever you talk about that, is that we're left then with a single model for what a successful woman leader can be, which is the Margaret Thatcher, Angela Merkel, Hillary Clinton, kind of the Iron Lady, where their warmth is not allowed to be part of the equation.
But why is that true?
It is true. Sarah Palin did not fit that model. Sarah Palin, I mean, for all her many flaws, for all her faults, she didn't play it like I'm, you know, strong and tough. I mean, she did this whole sort of mama bear kind of thing, which was very different and kind of cool. It didn't
but
work.
But she's not the only person who's doing this. We've had
Who else?
A lot of debates about exactly whether Sarah Palin is the only kind of mama bear alternative, and she's not. There's Debbie Wasserman Schultz, there's Kirsten Gillibrand, there's Amy Klobuchar. There are people who are out on the national stage who are acting in different guises of femininity, and more power to them. The question is whether a man like Michael Hayden, who is trying to put down a woman politician, can pull out this card in a dismissive way, not whether women can display emotions and talk about their kids and create this larger, more personal model and image for being in politics, which men can then hopefully follow too and do.
Can we briefly touch on the fight over the gender wage gap and the federal...
You mean the actual policy issue at stake here?
Well, maybe not the policy issue at stake. That seems too much. So the Republicans have blocked this law, which would have allowed more transparency in pay. Why bother to block it? Why not just let this go through 100-0, John? Why make a big deal out of it? It seems like we're going to a election. The Republicans' historic problem over the past 3 or 4 cycles has been saying things, doing things about women that get them in trouble. Why give Democrats an opportunity on something that is basically trivia? Being the law being proposed having been a quite small law.
I mean, there is a risk to it. I think where the risk is on something like this comes if Democrats continue to push on it and then some Republican member says or somebody running says something really stupid that makes a bigger assault or offends women sort of at their core. Now it's, you know, you can make a couple of claims. One, it's addressed at the state level, and that's where Republicans would prefer it to be addressed. You can talk about the distinction between the 77% women make 77% of men if you count it at annual wages, but 82% if you count it at hourly wages. That turns out that's not that far from the disparity within the actual White House. And what then you get into a policy conversation about the reason you have the disparities is because of the choices women make, the kinds of jobs they make, and therefore that the legislation will do more harm than good. You can get into a legitimate policy conversation and your base, because it's an off-year election, you don't have a lot of swing voting women that you would have in a presidential year, your base kind of would find it a greater break with Republican views to support this than you would pick up voters by voting for one thing and not campaigning
right.
on it constantly.
I guess that's – I mean, that's what's interesting is I actually think the Republicans are basically right on the issue. I mean, this particular
because
law.
You don't believe in wage transparency.
No, no, I said no, no.
Boss.
I kind of, but no, no, no. The wage transparency part, I'm kind of, I understand. It's more like the wage gap as an issue seems to me that the Democrats use get much more political mileage out of it than they deserve. That it's really it's as
Why?
My own
because
wife has written.
Sex discrimination is over?
No, not because sex discrimination is over. Because when you start to break down the source of the gap, it is not because there's a kind of grotesque discrimination in how people are paid. It's sort of choice of profession. It's the fact that, and this is a big issue, that women end up taking much more time and moving off of their career for longer for children. And
but why don't we need to talk about all of that?
We do need to talk about that, but that's not a wage – I don't think it's a wage gap issue. I think that's a adequate child care issue.
But I also think that pretending that discrimination is over and not a factor is wrong and lame and unhelpful, and that – the Democrats are doing a good thing by getting people to focus on this, even if the actual disparity in the wage gap is smaller if you're trying to start comparing apples to apples, and even if also we need to think about these larger structural contributing factors as well.
You know, one of the reasons Democrats are working so hard on this issue, of course, is to try to find a new one to talk about and to box Republicans in and get away from talking about the Affordable Care Act. As far as women and their economic conditions go, though, you can imagine, and I'm not enough of an economist to make this case, but two-thirds of the people who'd be affected by an increase in the minimum wage would be women. So that the actually better policy argument to have if you're a woman in this campaign, I think, is the minimum wage. But it presents less opportunities for a kind of outrageous moment where women can say, wait a minute, you're talking about me even if I'm not working. You know, so there's a greater gender chance of explosion
here. Jiu-jitsu there, John.
There is also a sense a lot of women have that there are small ways in which somewhere along the line they get a little bit screwed. And it's not that they don't recognize that maybe they took more time out, you know, on maternity leave than their husband did on paternity leave. But it's also that's not the whole thing. And over the course of your career, I think most women, I mean, it's certainly true for me, have some moment where they think, huh, was that fair? Is this because I'm not a good negotiator, or did I sort of miss some opportunity here that a guy would have gotten? And in this particular way, there are just lots of conversations about that.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, The Unknown Known, it's the new Errol Morris movie featuring interviews with the architect of the Iraq War, Donald Rumsfeld. And then Silicon Valley is a new HBO show from Mike Judge about the Uber nerds who build out our tech environs, making dynastic fortunes along the way. And finally, Spritz, the app that claims it will revolutionize the way you read. Joining me today is Julia Turner. Hello, Julia. You're the deputy editor of Slate. Clearly, I need to have the way I read revolutionized.
Hi, Stephen. I thought that was pretty good.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And, of course, Dana Stevens is Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Errol Morris is the maker of such documentaries as Thin Blue Line, Dr. Death, and Fog of War. He somehow convinced former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to sit for interviews, something like 34 hours of them. They have now been stitched together into the documentary The Unknown Known. Why would Donald Rumsfeld do such a thing? It's an obvious question, and Errol Morris, thank God, asks it. It's actually the final question of the documentary, and I won't give the answer away. We can talk about, well, why would we watch it? Dana, I assume it's because Americans have come to regard this war as a debacle of false pretenses and bloodshed. And what we want to see is either agonized remorse or possibly a smoking gun of some sort, maybe, you know, totally screaming false consciousness. We want to see something dramatic enough to counterpoint the horrible drama of the war. Dana, I'm curious to know whether you think we get that from this movie. Do we get something more subtle and more satisfying or what? What was your reaction?
I think, Steve, that we get something that's both much more subtle and much less satisfying than the documentary you describe. I mean, if you saw Fog of War, which was Errol Morris's Oscar-winning documentary from 2004, I believe, about Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, it's a completely different animal, even though structurally, formally, they're almost identical. It's Errol Morris sitting down across from this guy. There's no other talking heads brought in to talk about their impression of Rumsfeld or their memories of the war. It really is just a character portrait of this one person, and focusing specifically on his involvement in this one war. And in the case of the McNamara documentary, you get essentially almost sort of a moral I don't know, fairy tale. I mean, there's a moment toward the end of that documentary where McNamara essentially admits that the war was a mistake and is grappling with his conscience, that he was the architect of it. There's no such satisfaction in this documentary whatsoever. And the fact that Errol Morse continues to sit with Rumsfeld for 34 total hours of interviews while Rumsfeld continues his famously slippery obfuscation is, I think, what makes this documentary interesting, but also probably very frustrating for those who are waiting for some satisfaction in, you know, the story of the war.
Julia, what do you think? Frustrating, satisfying, elliptical, revelatory, what adjective would you supply?
In a way, watching this movie, it almost seems as though Donald Rumsfeld is a fictional creation designed to be the ideal subject for Errol Morris. I mean, Errol Morris is fundamentally interested in the question of what we can know and whether we can know it and how we know it.
And how storytelling sort of shifts the perspective on every memory that's recounted, right?
Yeah. And to me, this movie actually seemed less a counterpart to Fog of War than the natural counterpoint to Standard Operating Procedure, which we discussed on the show, which was Errol Morris's movie about what happened at Abu Ghraib. And to me, the most interesting part of this movie was the part where Donald Rumsfeld willfully refuses to grapple with his role in allowing those abuses to take place. But for Errol Morris to encounter someone whose most famous public utterance is about the unknown known, the known unknowns, and the unknown knowns just seems too perfect a marriage.
Right. I mean, I would call the movie in some ways both a study of Donald Rumsfeld, the individual, but also a study in modern decision making. It's on the one hand media driven and on the other very bureaucratic. Right? And both of these things together allow for someone with no real direct connection to the world to reshape the world, especially someone who runs the Pentagon. And so imagination is critical when you wield that kind of power. Someone who has a moral imagination, who has that power, will use it in a different way from someone who suffers from a massive dearth of moral imagination. And what's terrifying about Rumsfeld is he's, A, the poster child for that reality in some sense, and then he's also someone who loves to manipulate language in front of a microphone. And that is very evident in the movie. He will say something. Morris will quite deftly allow for a very long pause in order to allow Rumsfeld to respond internally to what Rumsfeld has just said. And Rumsfeld will say it, will sit stone-faced, and within 2 or 3 seconds, this kind of pleased Cheshire rictus of a smile will dawn upon his own face, and he'll be enormously self-pleased with what he said.
And one other thing that struck me about the interview is that the only moment where Rumsfeld loses his composure and seems less than utterly self-satisfied is a moment where he tears up when thinking about an American soldier he encountered, I think at Walter Reed, who was wounded and who wasn't going to make it. The doctor said, but his wife was filled with steely determination that he would make it. And then Rumsfeld goes back and visits the soldier a few weeks later and finds that the soldier has, in fact, pulled through. And Rumsfeld tears up at this. Now, you could argue that this is not, in fact, a moment of uncomposure from Rumsfeld, but in fact, a very cannily supercomposed moment where he tries to show some emotion at the human toll his decisions have made. But for me, it was very interesting that he did not seem to be concerned when he talked about the abuses at Abu Ghraib about the lives and souls and human element of the people who were actually tortured and shackled and abused and humiliated in that place. He seemed more concerned about it from a PR perspective or from the perspective of how it might damage the overall American war effort or the Bush administration. And the only actual human compassion he displayed is towards this American soldier. And it suggested to me there was just this utter compartmentalism in his mind between Americans and those in the rest of the world that felt dated and weird.
Yeah, I read a lot of reviews and responses to the movie saying that those were crocodile tears when he told the Walter Reed story. I don't think they were crocodile tears. I think he was legitimately moved. But actually, when I spoke to Errol Morris on the phone last week, I interviewed him about this movie at length. And something we talked about for a while, but that didn't end up making it into the published interview, was about that Walter Reed story, about which we both agreed that it was the emblematic story that Donald Rumsfeld would be moved by. It essentially tells the narrative that he wants to tell about the war at large that he can't tell, right? Which is that a miracle happened and it all turned out all right. And it has this kind of optimism against all odds that is completely not emblematic of how that war proceeded or how most veterans' experiences proceed in any way. And maybe that was why he holds on to that, you know, as something that he can believe in and be moved by.
That's fascinating. Mm.
All right. Well, the movie is The Unknown Known. It is from the director, Errol Morris. Check it out. Ambivalences aside, it's an absolutely essential thing. People should watch it. Coming up, the nerd pecking order in HBO's comedy Silicon Valley. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/GabFest. And while you're there, please, if you would, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/GabFest. Okay, well, moving on. Silicon Valley is the new HBO comedy from Mike Judge, creator of Beavis and Butthead and the great movie Office Space. His new show is about a hapless, low in the pecking order nerd at a giant Silicon Valley tech company who, almost unbeknownst to himself, comes up with a miraculous bit of code. Will it turn him into a gazillionaire? Will he take his sad sack incubator buddies along for the ride? Will he get hot women, the hot women, or will he get fleeced? Oh, the comedy. Let's listen to a clip from the show, and then we'll discuss.
So, what do you got?
Okay, here it is. Bit soup. It's like alphabet soup, but it's ones and zeros instead of the letters. Because it's binary. You know, binary is just ones and zeros.
Yeah, I know what binary is. Jesus Christ, I memorized the hexadecimal times tables when I was 14 writing machine code. Okay? Ask me what 9 times F is. It's 75. I do not need you telling me what binary is, just like I don't need you thinking about soup or taking pictures of it. I need you thinking about apps, software, websites. This is Silicon Valley, all right? Not Paris, Texas. It's where Campbell's soup is.
All right, that is not maybe the funniest clip from the pilot, but what I do like about it is that it features the voice of T.J. Miller, the guy who tells us about Flevendy-5 as an equation result. And I think T.J. Miller as this character, Ehrlich Bachman, who's a sort of wannabe Steve Jobs visionary, but is actually just sort of a big galoot with no social skills, is one of the better characters in the show. I mean, maybe this is just me. I have a huge soft spot for Mike Judge, okay? I think Steve and I agree that Beavis and Butthead is one of the great satirical achievements of the 90s. I also think King of the Hill is a hugely underrated show. I like his live action a little bit less than his animation, but I stuck with Silicon Valley. I had a 5-CD set of, you know, the ones that they released to the press and sat there and watched one after the other like popcorn. I mean, it's not a perfect show, but it made me laugh out loud hard at least once per episode.
I, who am not usually at a loss for words, am slightly struck with a lack of analytical insight when it comes to this show. One thing that's been interesting in reading the response to it is that most people agree it's pretty funny, but people seem to disagree about whether it is a penetrating or interesting satire of Silicon Valley or not, whether its goal is to skewer and pick at the peccadilloes of our coming tech overlords, or whether the show is simply set in a place with a lot of funny brand names and goofy-looking offices and pompous twits who, you know, have been the subject of comedy dating back for centuries and remain comedic in this day. And I think I lean towards the notion that this is a show that does not have very many interesting things to say about Silicon Valley, but is doing a fine and fun job of mining the territory for yucks. Steve, what did you make of it?
Well, first of all, I really liked it. Like Dana, I would have consumed much more of it, but I didn't have the 5-CD pack. Part of the problem is you're writing a satire about people who suffer from, I mean, they're kind of on the spectrum a little bit, and the comedy derives from the fact that they're so profoundly antisocial, but also incredibly smart, but smart in this narrow way. However, that narrow way creates our common virtual reality and makes them incredibly rich. Like the opening set piece is about them at a party for someone very like them, except that person has made it. And so Kid Rock plays the party and thinks that he's playing for a bunch of checked out douchebags. And it's all the stuff that we imagine about Silicon Valley paraded in front of us. Now, that raises a couple of interesting questions. First, how long can you stick with something that tells that joke over and over again? Are we going to go into a third dimension with these characters, which I actually thought happened a little bit at the end of the first episode? The galoot surprises us in a way that made me think, okay, if this turns into at least a quasi-human drama, I might really stick with it for the long term, and as opposed to just checking it out every now and then like Portlandia. And then the second question it raises is the one that Julia was alluding to, which is Silicon Valley getting the satire that it deserves in this telling kind of these jokes over and over and over again? Or is something about the nature of Silicon Valley being missed? Like, is it more interesting, various place than this satire can really comprehend? And what I thought was interesting about that was just you have Peter Thiel being sent up by this character, Peter Gregory. You know, he's a total libertarian. He thinks that going to college is a complete waste of time. And that's become a pathological point of obsession for Teal in real life. That's being sent up in the show, which I thought was a good choice. I've always wondered about why Teal is so obsessive about this. The show wonders about why its character, Peter Gregory, is so obsessive about this. Thought that was kind of funny. Farhad in the Times thinks that it's pretty accurate and pretty funny. Julia, you kind of have a horse in this race, maybe a little bit. Slate published a piece, but from someone who hates it on just this score, says it's inaccurate.
That's right. Steve David Auerbach, who writes our Bitwise column and worked as a developer for years at Microsoft and Google, and is intimately familiar with this world, wrote a piece for Slate this week utterly detesting the show and pointing out a number of things that it got wrong. In particular, he took issue with this show's portrayal of the gender politics of Silicon Valley. Willa Paskin, in her review, suggested that the show's lack of female characters was merely a reflection of the gender dynamics in Silicon Valley, but Auerbach contested that slightly and suggested that the show maybe could have more female characters than the one charming, warm, brown-eyed brunette who seems destined to become a love interest for somebody. But I have found in general that the mode of critique of the show, which is people from within the world assess whether it is an accurate satire of their world, it's sort of interesting to read that stuff, but that's not really the hallmark of success of the show. Veep doesn't work as a comedy because lots of White House staffers say that it does. It either has a ring of comedic truth or not. And I think it may be too soon to say whether this show has interesting ideas for us about the way technology gets made and the way it shapes our lives.
Yeah, it just strikes me that everybody who has a major bone to pick with this show about the way it shows the tech world is somebody who's from the tech world and who thus, in some way, is having their way of life satirized on screen. And as with The Social Network, which people decried right, left, and center for not accurately getting the internet, it didn't really matter to me. I just want it to be good drama and good comedy. And so far, I think the show is.
I have one final utterly goofy note.
Let's hear it.
Steve, you keep pronouncing it Silicon Valley, or as I pronounce it, Silicon Valley. Which of us is correct? Dana, be the tiebreaker.
Silicon. I think I go with con, but I don't know. I think that's it. That's probably one that could go either way.
You're such a suck up, Dana.
It's always splitting the difference. All right, let's ask the listeners.
Oh, boo. All right. Well, the show is called Silicon Valley. It's from Mike Judge, creator of Office Space and Beavis and Butthead and many other wonderful things. Dana, what's that great movie he made?
Idiocracy.
Yeah. Anyway, check it out. Tell us what you think of it. Okay, moving on. Reading is the sacred intersection between the privacy, silence, contemplation of an author and the privacy, silence, and contemplation of a sympathetic reader. That's what you think if you're Stephen Metcalf. If you're Spritz, you think reading is a sinkhole of inefficiency, and using their patented technology, you may be able to read Atlas Shrugged in under 10 hours. First prize, by the way, is not reading it at all. Julia, this is one of those topics that I'm convinced you select just to bait me into revealing my worst, most obnoxious, and snottiest self.
I didn't select this topic. You chose it. It was prompted by our intern. Reading comprehension of the meeting we were all in together?
Don't bedevil me with facts, woman. The thought of having my eyes spritzed with To the Lighthouse is going to turn me into...
Virginia Woolf in spray form.
Yes, exactly.
Ode to Woolf.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to turn me into the exact culture snob all our listeners have mistaken me for all these years. I charge you, guilty as charged. Julia Turner, defend thyself.
Okay, well, so first let's describe what Spritz is, okay? So our listeners have a ballpark before we start our knockdown, drag-out brawl. So Spritz is a new reading technology based on a at least decades-old idea, which is that the experience of reading written words laid out left to right in lines on a page is inefficient because your eye must hop, do left to right, jump back to the next line, scan. You know this feeling. Your eyes are darting back and forth along the page. Think of the wasted seconds that all those eye darts engender. So for several decades, there has been a notion that instead of darting our eyes along the page, we should look at a static area on the screen and have the words show up as serial flashing blinks of light so that our eyes don't have to scan and the words can just kind of flash at us subliminally. And then Spritz applies and refines this idea with a new reading technology that centers the word around what they call an optimal reading point so that your eyes can really fully focus and just have all of Atlas Shrugged or whatever other work beamed directly into your cornea. The Spritz website allows you to demo this technology and shows what it's like to read text at 300 words a minute, which feels fairly slow and comprehensible, and then allows you to try samples up to, I think, 650 words a minute, which begins to feel a little bit hasty. And it's kind of a fascinating technology, I thought. I was not immediately repulsed by it, but it seems that Steve was. Dana, were you?
Well, put it this way, I don't think Spritz is going to take over the world. I don't think it's going to be the Silicon Valley innovation that makes some bunch of guys in an incubator get filthy rich. I can't imagine that this is going to be the technology that makes us read differently or faster. But maybe it is the case that such a technology will develop. And I guess it could be interesting to talk about what that will mean. To me, this just seemed like it left out so many obvious advantages to having a text spread in front of you, which without even getting nostalgic about, you know, paper binding or codexes or the Gutenberg Bible, we could safely say. And one of them is that reading speed varies from moment to moment, depending on the circumstances of your reading, how well you're understanding it, how tired you are. You know, so the idea that you are setting some speed, be it slow or fast, and saying, this is how fast I want words to be fed into my eyeballs, is just a complete misapprehension of what it is to have your eyes dart across a page. They're not laboriously darting across a page doing this arduous work of moving. They are gathering meaning as they go. So in that sense, the darting time is the reading time. I don't see how it's wasted.
Yeah, I mean, I did find that it was very easy to comprehend the sentences flashing at me at ever faster speeds, with one exception. Spritz has a made-up word that they've used called the reticle, R-E-D-I-C-L-E, which is the rectangle in which the written material that you're trying to read goes into your eyeballs. It's a little oblong at the top of the page where the words flash up. It's not a word I'd encountered before. Maybe it's a word you guys know. I think it's a made-up, like, tech buzzword. And so in the very fastest or second fastest thing available on their site, they start talking about the reticle in the speed text. And I was feeling really good about myself because of how just goddamn fast I was reading everything they were flashing at me and having ambitious notions of how I was going to have read Life on the Mississippi by the end of lunchtime. And then they start throwing reticle at me, and I was thinking, retina, retinue, ridicule, like, what the hell? Like, and I lost the script, and then 20 words had flashed by, and I played it again, and I couldn't figure out. I never got the word. I was never able to comprehend it because it's not a word in my vocabulary.
Well, there you go, right? I mean, if you're really reading something that's challenging and interesting and presumably teaching you anything at all, then there's going to be a moment that your eyes have to go back and look at a word, and maybe you have to look up that word or look at what it means in the context. So the idea that reading is just sort of a tennis ball machine spewing words at you one by one just seems like we would have to completely rewire our brains to read in that way. I mean, of course, we haven't even gotten into the question of why do we all have to read Life at the Mississippi during lunchtime?
Well, we have to, because otherwise Steve won't have dinner with you. I don't know. The notion that the way we read, which is a relic of the technology we've used for reading for years, might be changed in the digital world seems totally fine to me. I'm completely open to the idea of it. But and I liked the idea that using a technology like Spritz might have a focusing effect. I mean, I think we've all had this experience. We're so used to Twitter and jumping around between 20 web pages and answering half of an email and then going to look at my Gmail on the other screen. And, you know, the sitting down with a long blank page and an empty brain and just focusing on it and continuously reading through one text can sometimes feel harder to focus on than it used to in my life. And the notion that it might be somewhat focusing to kind of zero in on this window, this reticle on a page, I was interested to try a longer or more ambitious text. So I think there's hope for a version of this technology, but it doesn't seem like it's there yet.
Yeah, Julia, I completely agree. I mean, you don't have to be a Gutenberg fetishist like Dana and I are in order to think that there's something a little silly about this. But I am a Gutenberg fetishist, so I'd like to attack it from that angle first, which is that, you know, what happened to the just pleasure of, like, your copy of Nicholas Nickleby or Martin Chuzzlewit or Being in Time? Or, you know, there's something about a book, the heft of a book, that represents the length of time, like, physically in your hand. The actual weight of it has a corollary in the amount of time that you're going to spend actually living with it and reading it. Therefore, it's a companion. It's meant to be both physically and in the theater of your mind, a companion to yourself over time. So there's the Gutenberg fetish line. I just don't think that you're ever going to read a serious novel, not even Atlas Shrugged, in this format. But then the second thing is, when you're reading informationally, Julia, exactly right. So then it becomes purely spatial, and you do want to print it out or at least have a spatial metaphor for paragraphs in specific places that need to be moved or rearranged or broken down and examined depending on what, you know, informational purpose you're trying to serve. I don't see how you could ever achieve that with this. I mean, the only thing I can think of is, like, these people are attempting to create something for Google Glass. They hope Google will buy it, and one day the kind of, you know, dork who goes around Google Glassed up will use this as a way on the little Google van to read huge volumes of research reports that are mostly data, informationally data-driven, a piece, you know, and it's just a way to kind of upload information into your brain, but very uncritically.
I don't know. I'm not sure it has to be uncritical, although thinking about you uploading research reports, it's interesting to think how a chart would play into this, right?
Or if poetry.
If you wanted to do any kind of text interspersed with a chart. And yeah, I was just thinking about the same thing. Poetry, for example, is a place where you see words in a spatial context, and that's totally fundamental to what you're doing. I also will object to the technology as the delicate wilting flower that I am. I have extremely sensitive eyes. I'm not sure if you guys know that, or you know, my pale blue eyes are just incredibly sensitive to sunlight, and I have to wear dark sunglasses every time I go outside, and my optometrist is very concerned about my delicate retinas. But I actually found the experience of using Spritz much more taxing for my eyes than the experience of reading on a page, especially on a bright screen that's emitting a ton of light. The experience of having my eyes motionless on that rectangle for however many minutes I played with the technology on the site, I found as soon as I closed it out and tried to look at the rest of the world, there was this hovering dark rectangle. You know how you get that after image when you stare at one thing in a fixed way for too long? And that after image hovered on my burnt retinas for like 10 minutes. I was like having trouble reading and looking at my email. So in terms of protecting your eyes, that all seemed like complete hogwash to me.
Complete hogwash. I mean, I feel like reading developed the way that it did over millennia for a reason, you know, and we are not used to staring straight at a page and having it fed at us for a reason, because our brain circuitry has by this point evolved, and in every individual life from babyhood on evolves to read while moving your eyes. The idea that suddenly in your mid-30s you would have somebody start throwing brightly lit words one by one into your eyeballs and then it would be analogous to the experience of reading seems to me insane.
But Dana, you know as well as I do that that's not the way technology assimilates into the culture. It doesn't go via 35-year-olds, you know. It goes via the young, and it'll skew younger and younger and younger until this is the way young people actually learn to read. I'm not being dystopic. I don't think that's actually going to happen. But
it's just not. It's not a good enough app. Maybe that will happen, but I don't think it's going to happen because of Spritz.
All right. Well, the technology is called Spritz. You can go to their website. Its URL is spritzinc. That's with a C. .com. Check it out. Tell us what you think the future of reading is at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Okay, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you have?
Okay, I'm going to endorse a fairly dense long read this week, something best not read in a Spritz reticle. It's an essay by Michael Markham, who's a music professor at one of the SUNY campuses, on a new book about Bach that just came out. So having just read a big, thick, chunky biography of Bach and feeling like, while I learned a lot about the time that he lived in and I learned a little bit about music, I still felt like I had read all the way through without understanding how did this person create this incredible music, which was the reason that I read it in the first place. So then I come across this wonderful essay in the LA Review of Books by Michael Markham that takes me through it and talks all about the perils of Bach biography and of biography of composers in general, and sort of really takes on some big critical questions of how do you write a biography of someone who lived in a completely different time with a completely different set of cultural values? And specifically, he talks about how at the beginning of the Romantic period, we start to understand composers as artists, right? That we see Beethoven, for example, or Wagner, people from this period as creators, you know, and we want to hear about their biographies. As soon as we go back a little bit further in time and music is more connected, as it was in Bach's case, to church bureaucracies and, you know, sort of churning out music on deadline, there's less of a sense of an intimate connection of the biography to the music. And the way he talks through that would be fascinating, I think, for somebody who cares nothing about musical biographies, cares nothing about Bach, just sort of cares about intellectual history. He does a beautiful job. So it's called Bach Psychology, Gothic, Sublime, or Just Human, and it appears in the LA Review of Books from a few weeks ago, but you can find it on their website, lareviewofbooks.org.
Oh, cool. Julia, what do you got?
I'm going to recommend a truly amazing book of poetry that is simultaneously a great book of poetry and the most illuminating thing I've read about the war in Afghanistan, I think, ever. It's called I Am the Beggar of the World, Landes from Contemporary Afghanistan, translated by Eliza Griswold with photographs by Seamus Murphy. And Eliza Griswold is a very interesting writer. She's a poet and also a foreign correspondent, basically. And there's a form of kind of lay folk poetry in Afghanistan among Pashtun women in particular called the lande. And it's kind of a folky way of communicating with each other. And in a really remarkable feat of intellectual and cultural reporting, Eliza Griswold met a number of these women, convinced them to share the Landes with her, worked to translate them into English, and has presented them here with a series of essays about how they fit into contemporary Afghan life, and along with just some gorgeous photographs of what modern life in Afghanistan is like. So I can't recommend it highly enough. A lot of it originally appeared in a really wonderful edition of Poetry Magazine, and it's been expanded and rejiggered slightly for this book edition. Again, it's I Am the Beggar of the World, Landes from Contemporary Afghanistan.
That sounds great.
Mm. God, that sounds amazing. Okay, very briefly, this week I'm going to endorse the Mark Danner series of essays about Dick Cheney in the New York Review of Books. I believe they're all available online to non-subscribers. Certainly most of them are. It came to mind because I was watching the Errol Morris documentary in frustration, again, not at Errol Morris, but at Donald Rumsfeld. And it did make me want for an authoritative, historically contextualized voice to describe what happened to us as a culture, as a society, thanks to this man's total lack of moral imagination. Well, this is exactly what Mark Danner's series of essays does about Cheney, who in some ways is the more Shakespearean figure than Rumsfeld. In a way, there's at least something identifiably internal and conflicted and, in my estimation, quite dark about Cheney, and this is what these essays are about. I think it's very satisfying and very intelligent essay reportage, and highly recommended. All right. Well, thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
Springtime can kill you just like a dead boy.